Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So I'm Josephine Ensign, and I'm here on Wednesday, May 8th, 2024, with Jody Rao. And Jody is a longtime public health nurse. Yay! And this is May is National Nurses Month. So happy Nurses Month to you.
Thank you.
And we're at Jack Straw Studios. So Jody, tell me what led you to the work that you do.
Yeah, it's a meandering story, so thank goodness
we can meander together.
We can meander, yeah. I was probably 19 and was, you know, doing college straight out of high school and ran out of money, so it was either paying for rent and bills or continuing with school, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do at that point, so in some ways, it was a very obvious and easy choice to make. So I dropped out of school. And during that break from school, I started working at a downtown Seattle women's healthcare clinic that primarily provided abortions. And it was the first time I'd sort of been on the other side of healthcare. And really through that experience, I got the just the shallowest glimpse in some ways, looking back, you know, 28 years at this point, of really the intersections of healthcare, education, and I identified it as politics at the time, but I think now I would label it more public policy, and certainly mm-hmm. politics has its role in that. And for the first time, I was like, I think I want to do something that lets me do all three of these things. And nursing was the path that I saw towards that. So I spent the next several years doing night school, working my way through my prerequisites and, you know, graduated from the University of Washington School of Nursing. And sort of through that process, the fourth pillar that came into play in that intersection of issues was community. Mm-hmm. And I was really honestly just very curious. Like, I didn't have a deep analysis of these things or how they intersected. I was just really, really curious, and it seemed key to me in some way. And so I started my career as a community and public health nurse, really doing primary care in community clinics and public health clinics, doing some nursing case management, worked on the mobile medical van with Healthcare for the Homeless Network. And through that, and that was probably a good, 10 to 15 years of my career of that direct clinical service, really started to see myself and my family reflected in the folks that I was working with, that I was serving, that I was helping to navigate these systems in a way that I hadn't when I started my nursing career, had thought about going into nursing. But as I started to look back, I was like, yeah, I had a period of time where I was on state subsidized healthcare because that was the only thing that was available to me. That was the only thing that was that I could afford. You know, Planned Parenthood was my primary place of healthcare for a very long time. And when I developed some chronic diseases, both physical and mental health, I, you know, needed to have better access to care. And thankfully, by that time, I had better access to insurance that allowed me to pursue that. Many of my family members have struggled with behavioral health, both substance use disorder and mental health. And so I was really seeing me and my family having navigated or benefited from some of the same services that folks were. And it was a shift for me because I think there may have been an insidious piece of maybe savior complex. And for me, it would be white savior complex as a white, cisgendered, you know, heterosexual woman. Lot of privileges wrapped up in that identity that I really, really started to see as contributing to the path and where I ended up. And without a lot of the safety nets and the privileges, would have easily or could have easily ended up, you know, on the other side of the healthcare, you know, dynamic. And as I was sort of deepening my understanding of healthcare and my role in it, and understanding the role that racism plays, and I mean, late stage capitalism and classism play into really a lot of the social determinants of health that people are navigating. I really felt like I wanted to move away from direct clinical care and really looking at the systems level and seeing how systems are impacting populations and individuals. And when I really think about homelessness, which is I've always worked with folks that are experiencing homelessness throughout my whole career in some form or another. And then when I went to Healthcare for the Homeless on the mobile medical van, that was primarily who I was working with. I really think homelessness is just where the failures of systems and either the good or bad public policy impacts really converge, and that and same thing with racism and classism. And I wanted to be able to work and participate in trying to shift systems, knowing that I spent a good first half of my career fighting against systems.
Including like working in a hospital setting, right?
Totally, right? I mean, it's you have all these incredible people coming together and it, you know, doing good work and sometimes really coming up against things that feel like they're insurmountable. I remember one of my first jobs as a nurse working in a community healthcare clinic. Possibly one of the most powerful things I did as a nurse was call a telephone company and advocate for an elderly woman with diabetes to not have her phone shut off so that she could actually stay connected to the clinic and have the ability to call 911 and check in and keep her diabetes in check. And it was so eye-opening to me.
Was it successful?
It was.
Oh, good job.
And it has stayed with me. I mean, that was probably a good 20 years ago at this point. And I can still see her face and I can still remember, you know, sort of having to wrap my head around, like, this is what community health nursing is about. And, like, yeah, it is. So for the past, you know, 5 years, I've really been working more at the systems level. And part of that was with Healthcare for the Homeless as the clinical quality lead nurse on the administrative team there. And then the last almost 3 years doing more policy and advocacy work with a local nonprofit.
You want to say what that is?
Yeah, the Seattle King County Coalition on Homelessness. Right. So we are comprised of close to about 60 organizations that provide housing, homelessness, and human services. And so that's really fighting for those policies and those funding requests and resources to bolster the support for folks once they've fallen into homelessness. And
so what kind of things do you do, like, on a day-to-day basis now?
Good question. So we really try to support the folks that are doing this work. So, you know, think about your housing case manager, your day shelter staff worker, your mental health provider, the folks working at food banks or providing meals for folks, outreach workers that are out there on the streets really trying to connect with folks, the folks that are staffing permanent supportive housing units. And we're really trying to understand, what do they need to do their jobs efficiently, effectively, provide really good quality, trauma-informed, person-centered care for the folks that they're working with. And so sometimes that's trainings, really working with folks and providers to just get the skills and the professional development to move them along in their career. But it's also fighting for equitable wages. Mm-hmm. For folks, because we're seeing huge vacancies in staffing across agencies, across the sector, high turnover rates. And we have examples in our community where, when organizations and agencies have been able to increase wages, staffing and employment can start to stabilize. And then you're able to retain a lot of that skilled expert knowledge, and you're not constantly bringing folks in, because this is really incredibly hard, complex work. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing increased complex physical and behavioral health needs of folks that are surviving homelessness. And I've started shifting my language from experiencing homelessness or living homeless to surviving homeless, because that is what I think people are doing, and we know homelessness is deadly. So that's a huge part of what we're doing. On the other side, we are learning from those same providers that we are trying to support about what are the issues that they are seeing, and how can we advocate that, advocate for things that are going to help them do their job better. So when we look at the Seattle, and specifically City of Seattle and the King County budgets, we are really looking at, are we investing in things like human services and affordable, deeply affordable housing? And if we're not, we're raising the flag around that. At the state level, we're really trying to improve and invest in, again, rent protections, affordable housing at the state level, public benefits, you know, so looking at food benefits, temporary assistance for needy families, Social Security at the state level, that's the age blind disabled cash benefit, and making sure that on the training side, providers know how to access that, know how to overcome barriers, know what to look for and how to support and advocate their clients for getting on those benefits, maintaining those benefits. Yeah.
That's a lot. Keeps you busy. Keeps you busy.
That it does.
And as we were talking a little bit before we started recording this interview, the offices of the coalition are down in Pioneer Square. So it's right down in the kind of the heart of the action, you know, where a lot of the kind of the nexus of a lot of the, especially chronic homelessness and services like Chief Seattle Club and Downtown Emergency Services Center is. So I imagine that just going into the office and being there must feel a bit like you're staying connected to the community.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. It's and it's a changing landscape, right? Because we from a public policy stance, capital we, have not decided that sweeps or moving people around who are living outside because they have nowhere else to go is we haven't figured out as a community and as a society that that is bad policy. And when you do that, you're not creating any solutions to homelessness. You're not providing people with, generally not providing people with services or services that meet their needs. What you're doing is you're moving people around and you're disconnecting them from any amount of stability that they may have been able to find, any sense of community or safety that they may have been able to find with the folks that they have, you know, chosen to live with. You're disconnecting them from outreach workers and service providers mm-hmm. who know how to find them and can follow up on the things that they're working towards, which are usually all the things that go towards working towards housing. So you're just increasing the time and the trauma that it takes to move someone from homelessness into housing.
An expense.
An expense. Thank you.
For everybody, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it is a changing landscape, and it looks very different than if you go into other parts of King County where it's a little bit more suburban or rural and maybe not quite so, quote unquote, visible. And so I think making sure that we as providers and particularly as advocates, whether it's, you know, us as the coalition explicitly or just those that identify as advocates and allies, are really truly in community and building relationships across the spectrum to really understand this issue is so key, in my opinion. And I think it also is an anecdote to what I think, and this is just my theory. You willing to push back on me or share your thoughts?
No, it's fine. I like theories.
I've been testing it out on different people for a few years now. I really wonder if collectively we are having some secondary trauma or some compassion fatigue because mm-hmm. it is extremely hard to see the pain and the suffering and the loss of what it is to live outside without the safety of a door to lock behind you, a bed to sleep in.
A bathroom.
And I think nobody wants to see that. And I think it's probably a pretty natural protective factor to then distance yourself from that and to then other and to think that is the failing of an individual, not the failing of multiple systems in public policy and really investments and values that we've decided to fund mm-hmm. as a society. Because the reality is that most of us are probably one, maybe two crises away from being unstably housed or couch surfing or not being able to pay the rent on that path towards losing that stability of housing. And once you fall into that, it's incredibly hard to get back out.
And then also the role of medical debt and cascading, and then, you know, people, especially with sweeps, also of then getting fines they can't pay, getting jail time, and everything else that just makes it, just deepens the suffering and cost to society as well as to an individual, right? And so what do you do? Because I think a lot of people, I mean, I think a lot of people who are doing direct service, right, and the people that you're coalitioning for, advocating for, the frontline workers, understand this, you know, at pretty fundamental levels. But I don't think the general public really understands that, and probably not the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, hearing grants pass, you know, Oregon versus Johnson. So what do you do personally, and what does the coalition do to try to kind of open up that understanding and education?
Personally, I'm engaged in my community, so I live in Burien, and right now the Burien City Council in particular has chosen to, criminalize mm-hmm. homelessness. And so I'm engaged and active in my community with advocates. They're really trying to figure out what are the strategies that are going to work, because we do not have even close to a majority of our city council that is going to listen to us. But we show up regularly at those city council meetings. We make our voices heard. We participate in, you know, I sign on to letters. I do a lot of education and conversation just with my family and my mm-hmm. friends that, you know I do this work. I think in many ways have some understanding because of their connection to me and the work that I do, their own personal interests, but can unpack some of that nuance and that complexity a little bit for them. As the coalition, we try to do that at scale for folks, mm-hmm. right? We really try to highlight issues that are coming up across any jurisdiction within King County, or even all the way up to the federal. Right. We just had a really amazing community advocacy briefing that we co-hosted with the Northwest Justice Project and the ACLU of Washington, really trying to understand, you know, the legal complexities of Grants Pass versus Gloria Johnson, along with some local cases, including case at Burien and City of Seattle.
Versus Long. Going way back, the Homesteading Act. One.
Yes, yeah. Yes. We talked about that. And then the City of Seattle and Kitchen, which I'm a little less familiar with. So trying to understand the legal lay of the land with some of those cases. We had a second section that really brought in those frontline providers to really try to help illuminate some of those realities, as you said, that frontline providers understand on a very deep and fundamental level, but that we as a general public don't get access to, because mm-hmm. too often we're learning about homelessness or seeing it largely through the media, and it is sensationalized and it's generalized.
Polarized.
Polarized, thank you. And really, homelessness is complex and nuanced as any individual that you meet, you know, or they're seeing what it looks like as they walk by on the street or mm-hmm. in their community. And then that is, you know, that image or that experience is, you know, overlaid with whatever messages the media is giving, which, you know, often reiterates myths and tropes that don't hold true, right? Mm-hmm. We know root causes of homelessness are racism and a lack of housing, you know, our top two, right? We do not have enough affordable housing. When we get people housing, you start to see all of the other issues. Their health care improves, their mental health improves. If they have a substance use issue, that improves. And like you said, all the costs that are associated with dealing with those things that are getting progressively worse by living homeless, that all starts to go away as well. So we really try to highlight when those issues are coming up for a community, and we really try to explain the impact of what that will do and how folks can advocate for or against it. If it's a good policy and we think it's at risk, we want to, you know, get all of our might behind it. If it's a bad policy, we want folks to understand why and state what is good and mm-hmm. push back against it. So, and making that easy and accessible for folks and translating some of that really heavy policy, sometimes hard to track and understand the implications of, really translated into mm-hmm. into something that's digestible that people can feel like they can act on.
And probably also, I mean, obviously the grants pass, I mean, the sweeps and the criminalization of homelessness is hugely important always, but highlighted right now, not just in Burien, but across our country. So the pushback, especially kind of conservative, kind of what I call anti-homeless, blaming people, of housing first. Mm-hmm. And so how do you, again, kind of individually and with the coalition, push back against that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's something we're all struggling with because we've been on the defensive for so mm-hmm. long, and trying to shift out of being on the defensive and starting to talk about what is working in ways that aren't using some of those what have become buzzwords, which is a sad state of affairs. You know, it's hard to say that housing first, which is just a really incredibly effective, sound, evidence-based approach and policy, to say it's become a buzzword, but I think it has. Mm-hmm. But to start to shift the narrative around how we talk about things that are really going to connect with people's emotional state, right? Because I think if you can somehow subvert or get a crack in that polarization, and you can really start to connect. I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone that thinks homelessness is a good thing or would openly state, like, yes, I think some people should be homeless.
We need more homelessness.
You know, so if we can figure out how to have the dialogue and how to open communication that gets at the heart of what I think people really believe. Now, I am not Pollyanna about this. I don't think that's going to, like, magically make people, like, sign on to what I think is going to be the right way to do it. But I think you can at least start to open that dialogue, and you can really start to hopefully start to shift people to start to understand that homelessness isn't a trait or an essence. It is something that a person is living through, and it is a failure of so many things, and it is not something that a personal failing of somebody. And I think you can start to shift that, and that starts to open up other dialogue of, like, okay, then how do you address it? And mm-hmm. get to some of those really important conversations that we're just not having as a society or as a community, but maybe not even individually, which is, yeah, what we invest into homelessness, housing, and human services could seem like a lot of money to someone that isn't in this work.
Or who doesn't live in Scandinavian countries.
That too. And so when you – but to have them understand that that's actually not even close to what we need to address this problem, you really have to start to to tear down that narrative that we're throwing money at this problem and it's not getting better, it's not getting better, right? You really need to start to have people understand that, like, with that money, we're doing incredible amounts of work that's successful. We just have more people falling into homelessness upstream than we're able to take out. And when you start to have that kind of a complex open dialogue with someone, I think you really can start to unearth solutions and get more people to see it in a new way.
Mm-hmm. So to start emphasizing what works and positive stories again without becoming a Pollyanna. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I think that that understanding of the continuum in the spectrum, all the way from, you know, what are we doing with homelessness prevention and what's working there and how we're not investing enough there. And then once people fall in, we haven't invested enough on the other end to really move a ton of people. There's a lot of people that are ready to move out of homelessness and would love to if we had resources, but we haven't invested in those. And that's going back decades, you know.
And then preventing people who have gotten housing, have survived homelessness, have gotten housing, but to help them have the supports to be able to stay in housing so that they don't cycle back into homelessness.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's another really key thing that needs to be clear, for lack of a better word, around housing first. And really, I think this could be true about, you know, just generally understanding homelessness is we throw around a lot of different terms that get used differently and defined differently. And so we're not having clear, transparent conversations because we're using the same words defined differently. But when we talk about housing first, we are really talking about getting someone into permanent housing that has those services that are available, so case management, healthcare, behavioral health services, meal support, you know, just all of those things are available at scale at an appropriate ratio for who's living in the building that meets their needs. You see huge, huge success. You can't just put somebody into housing and one case manager to, you know, one building and expect that people are going to have the support they need to maintain that unit in a healthy way that lets them thrive.
Or that the case manager can stay long enough and doesn't burn out.
Good point.
And run out of the building, never to return.
Yes.
Yeah, now that is something, kind of the rhetoric around housing first, of how misused it can be, because it really is a very specific evidence-based model of care, but it has bled out into kind of appropriated uses and misuses, which is quite interesting and upsetting to hear. Yeah. So what would you say? I mean, here you are, yay, public health nurses, and you know, and you've walked the walk. I mean, the breadth of your work, you know, working kind of case management stuff, nurse manager sorts of things, like at UW Medical Center Emergency Department, you know, seeing a lot of people surviving homelessness coming through, working on the medical outreach van, healthcare for the homeless, and others, and now with advocacy work. So what would you say to, like, some of the students that I'm working with who might be interested in public health, community health, nursing, might be interested, or anybody, no matter, you know, health profession or whatever, wanting to get into work, especially around healthcare for the homeless? What would you say to them?
It's a great question.
Like, what is anything that you wish that you, I mean, some of it you just have to know, you have to learn by experience, but are there things that you kind of wish somebody had shared with your younger self?
Yeah, My initial thought when you asked that question was like, come. It's the most rewarding, joyous work you can possibly do. And you will meet incredible people, which I'm sure, a pediatric nurse would probably say too if somebody was there. But I was not encouraged to do community public health nursing when I went through my nursing program, 20 years ago. It was still, I think, a norm that as a nurse you go into hospital work and you get your skills.
Finishing school is what I call it. Yeah. You have to get your chops in med surg or you won't be a real nurse.
Exactly. Yes. And thankfully I didn't listen.
Good.
Yeah. but I think what I would say is I actually think you ask the general public, people have an image of a nurse and have no idea what we do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's even more true of like public health and community health nursing. And so I wish I had a better answer for this. I wish I'd had time to think about this. But you can do so much with community and public health. You really can work at more of that individual level with folks. You can work at that population level with folks, or you can really pull up into that systems folks. And there's actually a lot of jobs that allow you to navigate all mm-hmm. three of those things mm-hmm. within a single job, which I think is incredibly important and was invaluable in my career to be able to stay connected to individuals mm-hmm. and have that one-on-one relationship and care and understand the policy decisions that were being made and or even just, system stuff like within a clinic or, within public health and how that was impacting or how those were affecting how I was able to deliver mm-hmm. care and then to come back and say,
we need more resources.
We need more resources or this is not the data that we should be gathering, we need data shouldn't be or a particular data point shouldn't be driving care. Care should be driving how we're learning, mm-hmm. To a certain degree. Yeah, I don't know. I might be too close to the work or too far from it at this point. I'm not sure. If I have another thought, I'll.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's I'll fine. Share. I threw you a curveball on that one, but yeah, as I just think about that a lot because yeah. I teach public health community nursing. And students that are interested in it, but they still get those messages like you got of you can't go straight from like a BSN program into public health, community health nursing. And it's like, yes, you can. Yes, you can. I mean, okay, yeah, maybe it won't pay as much, but if that's where your heart is, I mean, we know even from economics, right, the right person, the right fit for the job is better for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
And forcing somebody into a hospital-based med-surg unit, if that's not where their heart is, you don't want that nurse caring for your loved one or you.
No, that's a really great point. And not that you're not going to learn valuable lessons mm-hmm, mm-hmm. by, working in a hospital setting. But if really your goal is to move into community, start your career there. Right. You're that finishing school, like you said, isn't what you need, you know, for the most part, you know, for the most part.
And there's all sorts of like continuing education or things like if you want wound care, right, which is hugely important for kind of street level, street nurses, healthcare for the homeless. You can get that. You don't have to be on the med-surg unit necessarily.
No. And in fact, learning what it's like to do that in the field as opposed to at a bedside
yes.
is a very different thing. Particularly when you are thinking about this is someone on the street has really a lot of competing priorities. Mm-hmm. They may be trying to figure out where they're going to get their next meal or to get the documentation that's going to get them into housing or just where they're going to sleep that night.
And not get beaten up or have stuff stolen.
Exactly. So your time with that person could look a little different. Simply just how you organize to set up and provide care on the street. Infection prevention measures look very different.
Yes, they do. You don't have a nice little sterile cart.
No, you don't. No, you don't. So I think, yes, you're going to learn the good, solid basics of wound care and the appropriate dressing to put and to identify the type of wound and create a treatment plan. And that is all valuable. You're going to get that just as solidly, you know, in the public health center or the community clinic or the outreach team,
mm-hmm.
Like you said, with the training or the continuing ed that you get, but you're going to learn it in a way that's actually applicable to the setting that you're delivering that care in.
Great. And then what would you say, and what have you, like people that you've worked with who strive to balance the like possibly like the direct service, the direct care, individual patient care or group care with like systems change and advocacy, just in terms of a burnout, time, all of those kinds of things?
I think it's really hard. In fact, it was something that I struggled with immensely when I was doing direct care, and I didn't feel like I had the capacity or the time to do some of that systems and advocacy work. It's a huge piece that I carry into my work at the Coalition. Remembering what it was like mm-hmm. to be out in the field, barely able to check my emails. So trying to keep that as simple and as accessible as possible. Trying to convey to folks that there's a number of ways with which you can use your experience and your voice, and there are advocates and folks at the Coalition and folks at many of our organizations that can help you do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, if someone had said to me, you don't have to do it all, you are focused on the individual and providing incredible care, and if you are able to even periodically, you know, show up and share your voice, that's going to be immensely more impactful. I think in my mind, I sort of had to do it all, and you don't have to do it all. You know, there are folks at the policy and the advocacy level that are similarly focused on those policies and those systems and creating that bridge for how we can kind of meet in the middle around particular issues with frontline providers to get their story, to get their voice, to get their experience, to get their realities and their needs and highlight that. We can do the hard work of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think finding the person in your organization that does that, and a lot of larger organizations have someone that's doing policy work, connecting with spaces like the Coalition or Mutual Aid, other grassroots organizing. And again, it doesn't have to be, you know, the second full-time job that you don't have energy for. Mm-hmm. It's just having a connection truly to those folks. So when the moment arises, you have an easy access to share your voice, and then you can stay focused on that direct work if that's the thing that brings you joy and, you know, your gift to the world is primarily there.
Right.
Well, and to keep people updated on policy kinds of issues that are happening, that, like, if you're working direct service, you don't necessarily have the time to do that research to keep on top of things.
Correct.
In as much depth, which is really helpful.
Yeah.
Healthcare, National Healthcare for the Homeless Clinicians Network.
So good.
Yeah. Huge. Advocates that they have as well.
Yeah.
As well as just practical, like wound care. What wound care on the streets, what it's really like and how you can do it in a quality way, but you know, based on reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Those trusted organizations that you know are providing evidence-based, researched policy proposals that you can just lean on and just use their language, use their words. Like, you don't have to do it on your own. I think that's a great example of a way to advocate and also find what's important to you, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to advocate for all
everything,
the things.
Right? Exactly. All the time.
What's the thing that, you know, is driving your passion? Mm-hmm. Find that thing. Find the agency that's doing that work and stay connected to them.
Right. That sounds good. Yeah, I think about the National Coalition Homelessness and the Law Center on Homelessness of Housing Not Handcuffs as their logo, kind of pushing back against the increased criminalization of homelessness, which, of course, we've had since the beginning of time, too. And we should have learned our lessons, but we don't, right?
No.
So is there anything that I haven't asked you that you were hoping to talk about?
Well, I think the one thing that I was reflecting on is what we learned around health and homelessness through the pandemic, and maybe what we're not holding on to.
Give some examples, please.
So through the height of the pandemic, I was at Healthcare for the Homeless Network at Public Health, and it was the first time I think we had a glimpse at what starting to get to appropriate levels of funding and staffing could look within public health, right? I'm not even going to go outside of that, but what that could look like to support all of those providers in housing, shelter, outreach teams with the work they're doing. So we went from, we took a model that we had in through the hepatitis A outbreak, where I think King County Public Health did an unusual thing. We looked at what was happening in San Diego in particular and the millions of dollars that were being spent to bleach the streets, do 24-hour staffing on porta potties so they wouldn't get
dirty,
trashed, you know, stolen. Millions of dollars, reactive implementation in interventions. In King County, we were starting to see our cases of hepatitis A, particularly in people that were living homeless, and IV drug use and men who have sex with men. And we really said, let's not spend millions of dollars in a reactive intervention. Let's do some preventative work, which is sad that that's a kind of shocking way to invest our money. And yet it is, you know, we see that all the time. So we had a very small team of nurses that went into, started out going into shelters and day centers and permanent supportive housing sites offering vaccinations. Mm-hmm. We'd done this seasonally with flu for many, many years, and we added hepatitis A, and then we went from just seasonally to year-round because hepatitis A is not seasonal. And then eventually we took it into folks that were living on the street and outside. And that was a really, really successful model. And we were actively combating the outbreaks. And we did not get to the place where many other places across the country were seeing in terms of their hepatitis A outbreak.
And probably cost effective.
Totally. For fraction of the price. Mm-hmm. Fraction of the price. Turns out I did not become a millionaire from that. As the case may be. So we took that model, and we, when the pandemic rolled out and we were getting ready to have access to vaccines and in mass, we scaled that up.
Mm-hmm. Really quickly.
Really quickly. And we were able to do that same thing for COVID vaccines. And we were able to partner that with a team that did a lot of assessment and education that had been started prior to vaccines becoming available, that were going out and either proactively going into homeless service sites to assess their mitigation practices, you know, what they were doing really well to help keep disease at bay and prevent transmission, how they could improve, how they could shift services for folks, that team, and then educating staff and, you know, clients and residents and guests of those spaces. That team would also go back into those spaces if an outbreak had happened and really start to do assessments of folks, help move people into isolation and quarantine units, mm-hmm. which was another major, major investment. And I think somewhere at some point I heard that another public health entity somewhere in the nation called our model the Cadillac model.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not appreciate that because it felt a little bit could be taken derogatory as opposed to just
the electric vehicle.
Yeah, or like that this is somehow luxury as opposed to just what people deserve, which
That's
is
true.
Holistic care that when they go into an isolation and quarantine unit to stop the transmission of COVID to other folks in the congregate setting that they were living in, that they absolutely deserve care to deserve access to behavioral health care, nursing care 24/7,
housing
case management,
options. Yes.
Housing options, referrals, connections to care. Like to call that a Cadillac model, I was highly offended because to me it was very basic.
Mm-hmm.
And to have their needs met for where they were with whatever they were struggling with, whether it was a physical health condition or a mental health or, you know, substance use condition, they were going to get the needs that met and they were
right.
going to get access to treatment options.
It was a national model, not Cadillac, but it was a national model. I mean, you know, even people contacted me for God knows what reason, you know, from other cities in terms of the connection with what you all were doing here.
Oh, that's fabulous to hear. Yeah, that's great. And, you know, I think it, you know, it scaled down as the pandemic waned and it got smaller and it shifted. And in some ways it needed to, right? We didn't have the same need for that scale. But we've needed a version of isolation and quarantine going back 20 or 30 mm-hmm. years, you know, episodic communicable disease outbreaks in congregate settings.
Yeah, medical respite for just
medical
other
respite.
Things.
Yeah, I mean, TB clinic has needed this for years. So I, perhaps naively, was really hopeful that we were going to learn from the amazing work that we as a community did through the pandemic with appropriate levels of funding and staffing, that we were going to continue that because it's what should have been happening all along. It shouldn't have taken a global pandemic. And we did save lives. And to see that scaled back and to see staffing cut and it is incredibly painful for me to see. One thing that I think has stuck is we as a community, particularly homelessness, housing, human services, really said we're not going to do congregate shelter anymore.
Yeah.
And that is so heartening. So heartening. To see that we are, and it's not gone completely, but it is dramatically shifted and significantly less than what it was from 200 plus mats on the floor, 6 inches apart from each other.
Chaotic.
Chaotic.
Despite the best efforts.
Yeah. So heartening to see that that seems to be a lesson that we are sticking to and maintaining and... yeah, so I think it's something that like we haven't really captured what went really, really well during the pandemic and built on that, with the exception of you know, no congregate shelters. And we're seeing the effects of what didn't go well. The people that were really kind of stranded and abandoned and left outside and just the isolation that we all experienced through it. And we're seeing that in increased suicide rates and mental health and substance use and, you know, all of that. But even the rent protections and the eviction moratoriums, you know, I think the pandemic gave us a glimpse into what could be a beginning point. And I would love to engage in those conversations of how we continue to get back to that.
Right.
Find our way back.
Even the dramatic reduction in childhood poverty because of all of the the, you know, supports for kids and families. That obviously also impacts in terms of families, kids falling into homelessness.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, those missed opportunities. I will never forget an older woman who I saw as a patient / guest at Elizabeth Gregory Home in the fall, who, you know, we were able to do the COVID test. She was really sick. And she'd been living outside. And, you know, COVID positive, and where we called, you know, for housing assistance and stuff through the health department, et cetera. And it had been, or it was like being severely reduced. And I was just like, what do you mean? I mean, we're just, you know, like, what do we do with this woman? And I, you know, there I was trying to advise the you know, the staff and administration of Elizabeth Gregory about how to keep other people safe. This, when we're sick, right, that's such a vulnerable time. Here is an elderly woman, you know, with COVID, really sick, living outside, that, you know, we knew if we still had like the INQ, you know, isolation, quarantine, or a hotel room with supportive services, she could not only get better, reduce the spread in the community, but also potentially get off the streets permanently. It just broke my heart.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's not your fault. It's the system. And it's our collective will to keep those things going.
Yeah. And really, I don't think it's too harsh to say our values.
Mm-hmm.
You know, budgets are a policy document that mm-hmm. reflect our values.
Right. Where you want to put your money.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. I don't want to end on a not cheering note, but you know, I want to thank you so much for the work that you do, have done, continue to do. It's quite inspiring. Appreciate it, and I appreciate you taking time today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was my pleasure, and I was honored.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.